This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Welcome to the world of Forbes, Barron's, and Fortune magazines. This is brought to you by the good folks at Mind's Eye Organization. My name is Greg Conroy. So let's get down to business. From Forbes magazine, we have Control. The House Ruthless Built, March 26, 1984. 4 years before his death in 2020, Jack Welch wrote a post on LinkedIn titled, "Why I Love Micromanaging and You Should Too," a nod to his domineering 20-year reign over General Electric. 3 years into his tenure, Forbes spoke to Welch for a March 1984 cover story when the then 48-year-old CEO was still strengthening his iron grip on every part of the company. Quote, "In earlier years, Jack Welch earned the nickname Neutron Jack, as in a neutron bomb," close quote, we wrote. Quote, "This is because it was said that after he went through a plant, the building was there, but the people weren't," close quote. At the time, GE had $27 billion in sales, about $86 billion today, selling everything from jet engines to refrigerators. Welch pioneered the so-called, quote-unquote, rank and yank approach to HR, in which each year all GE employees were measured against their peers. The bottom 10% were unceremoniously fired. "Without such actions," Welch told us, quote, "over the years you drag the whole business down to a level, parceling out to the weak instead of infusing a winning attitude in the whole," close quote. Though once lauded, Welch's management style has fallen out of favor. In 2024, an over-leveraged General Electric broke into three separate companies, marking the end of a 132-year-old American icon. Here's some quotes. "My life didn't please me, so I created my life." Coco Chanel. "It was the detail others might not notice that destroyed for her the pleasure of achievement." By Elspeth Huxley. "Freedom is the only worthy goal in life. It is won by disregarding things that lie beyond our control." Epictetus. "Of all men's miseries, the bitterest is this, to know so much and to have control over nothing." Herodotus. "Perfectionism is self-abuse of the highest order." Ann Wilson Schaaf. "What a man's mind can create, man's character can control." Thomas Edison. "All truly civilized people, the ancients no less than us, have civilized themselves through the willful repression of the old animal self." Donna Tartt. "I am indeed a king, because I know how to rule myself." Pietro Aretino. "Humility means accepting reality with no attempt to outsmart it." David Riccio. "Fools give full vent to their rage, but the wise bring calm in the end." That's from Proverbs chapter 29, verse 11. "To be in hell is to drift. To be in heaven is to steer." George Bernard Shaw. "If I give, I control. If I take, I am controlled. If someone offers me something for free, I am at once suspicious." Margaret Forster. "Tiny details imperceptible to us decide everything." W.G. Sebald. "I love being at the center of things." Margaret Thatcher. And finally, "Perfection does not exist. To understand it is the triumph of human intelligence. The desire to possess it is the most dangerous kind of madness." Alfred de Musset. Here's a final thought. "To rule, first rule self." B.C. Forbes. Here's a commentary column by Steve Forbes, editor-in-chief of the magazine. "Make the dollar great again." Certain members of the Trump administration seem to be taken in by the siren call of a weak dollar. The idea is that cheapening the value of the greenback will improve our trade balance by making imports more expensive and our exports cheaper. This ignores the real-world reality that any short-term advantage will be overwhelmed by the inflationary damage to the domestic economy that a devalued dollar will wreak. In the early 2000s, the George W. Bush administration believed a gradually weakening dollar would boost trade and help the economy. The result was the debacle of 2007-2009, from which we still haven't fully recovered. The hard truth is that a mighty dollar is crucial to maintaining the U.S. as a powerful world leader. National security experts ignore how a strong currency is critical to a country's global strength. However, a currency that's reliably stable in value and is trusted to stay that way can enable a country, if it so chooses, to exercise a seemingly outsized influence in the world, economically and militarily. Strong, stable currencies are essential for economic growth. They lead to the development of domestic capital markets and financial institutions that can both fuel internal expansion and facilitate the creation of international supply chains. The trustworthy dollar was key to making the U.S. the financial capital of the world. Centuries ago, the northern provinces of the Habsburg Netherlands, which became the Dutch Republic, fought off their Spanish overlords, who were, on paper, far richer and stronger. Thanks to its trusted currency, the Dutch Republic became a capital powerhouse and created a globe-girdling empire. The world's first stock exchange opened in Amsterdam in 1602. When a Dutch prince, William of Orange, became King of England in 1689, his new realm was at best a middling power. But William brought a Dutch sense of finance with him, and this helped lead to the creation of the Bank of England, which undergirded the British pound that, in terms of gold, wouldn't change value for well over two centuries. Britain developed an increasingly sophisticated financial system. Even though this smallish island was a fraction of the size of France, its capital markets enabled it to successfully finance the global contest with France, whose crude financial system was a severe handicap in financing those wars. Great powers don't have feeble currencies. A particularly misbegotten idea seriously hobbled France's economy in those times. The belief that economic strength came from a strong government micromanaging the economy and maintaining trade surpluses. The more gold and silver a country could get its hands on and hoard, the more powerful it was, went their thinking. This statist approach was called mercantilism. Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations demolished this constipated notion. Both buyer and seller gain from a transaction, he correctly pointed out. Trade enhances the creation of wealth and leads to greater and more widespread prosperity. Smith's Britain leapt ahead of France. Unfortunately, various forms of mercantilism emerged in the 20th century. One variation poisoned the 1930s. A country would devalue its currency to supposedly gain a competitive advantage against its trading partners. It's no surprise that other nations followed suit. The result was chaos and economic immiseration and ultimately World War II. The U.S. triggered a global trade war and depression with its enactment of the notorious Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act in 1930. We once again fell for the illusion that cheap money can stimulate growth when President Richard Nixon began a series of dollar devaluations in 1971, ushering in a decade of virulent inflation and the belief that the U.S. was a nation in decline. It wasn't until Ronald Reagan took office after the terrible 1970s that the inflationary beast was finally slain. A weak dollar begets a weak country, and there's nothing great about that. Here's another tidbit from Mr. Forbes. The roundup of hundreds of South Koreans at the Georgia Hyundai factory underscores the immediate need to face up to the growing immigration crisis. President Trump pulled off a miraculous achievement by shutting our once-open border shortly after resuming office and relentlessly deporting gangs and other criminals who had illegally entered our country. Now, however, we're facing a different, more difficult challenge: what to do about the millions who have entered the U.S. illegally, not just those who came in during the Biden administration, but also those who have resided here for years, even decades. Most have otherwise been law-abiding and have sunk roots here. There are also those, estimated to number some 2.5 million, who were brought here as minors by their parents and are referred to as dreamers. The roundup of the South Korean illegal workers in Georgia vividly illustrates that broader sweeps to catch and deport illegals who are not otherwise lawbreakers is starting to hurt parts of the economy, most notably agriculture, construction, hospitality, and high tech. House cleaners, landscapers, and aides for the elderly will be affected as well. More and more, the public will react negatively to mass arrests of immigrants who, other than entering the country illegally, have been law-abiding. Concerning the Dreamers, President Trump should push legislation to make them permanent residents and end the endless uncertainty. Many now are raising families and pursuing careers. They wouldn't have the right to vote. Dealing positively with this particular issue has broad support. Work programs should be enacted for agriculture, construction, and perhaps various service industries whereby immigrants could legally come into the country and work in areas where they are needed for periods of time. Many of the arrested South Koreans were highly skilled technicians and engineers and were here temporarily to get the facility operational. The same is certainly true at other foreign-owned plants and labs that are being opened in the U.S. The need for skilled people here is real. We badly need a scalpel approach for would-be students from other nations. We don't want to lose future talent to other countries. After all, almost half of our largest companies were founded by immigrants or their children. For the millions of current illegal residents, we should devise an approach through which they could apply for at least a temporary residency. All this underscores the need to drastically simplify our current immigration system. People who play by the rules can find themselves in limbo for years. Here's an article about restaurants in New York City. Go, consider, stop. Edible enlightenment from our eatery experts and colleagues Moni Begley, Richard Nally, and Randall Lane, as well as brothers Bob, Kip, and Tim. Mission Ceviche at 1400 2nd Avenue at 73rd Street. Chef Jose Luis Chavez and partner Bryce Mastroluca offer authentic Peruvian cuisine with Nikki Japanese and Chifa Chinese influences in one of the Upper East Side's most popular restaurants. For starters, try yucca fries served with huancaina, a six-month-aged manchego cheese and black truffles, market oysters, or guacamole with matcha sauce. Ceviche, the anchor of the restaurant, are offered in various presentations. The raw fish are quote-unquote cooked by marinating them in lemon and lime juices with various spices added along with onions, cilantro, peppers, and tomatoes. For main courses, try the grilled bronzino accompanied by a spicy traditional chorolana sauce, rice and sweet potatoes, or for a chifa experience, try the arroz chafa, a wok stir-fried chicken, Peruvian Chinese fried rice, egg tortilla, sweet plantain, and wonton. Finish with the choclo con queso, a sweet corn cake brulee with queso fresco ice cream. Next up, Lex Yard, Waldorf Astoria, 550 Lexington Avenue at 50th Street. It's wonderful to see this old dame hotel looking lively and fresh after closing for renovations almost a decade ago. Lex Yard is the new major restaurant in the hotel, its name derived from the tracks that used to whisk presidents and potentates from the hotel to Grand Central. The lower level, directly accessible to Lex Ave, offers updates on some old classics, such as a new Waldorf salad with a refreshing bright citrus dressing that still features the traditional walnuts and apple. The lobster roll is prepared with truffles and caviar. Black bass is cooked to perfection. For dessert, try either the chocolate budino or the olive oil cake, or share some of each. Next, Stella 34 Trattoria and Bar, Macy's Herald Square, 151 West 34th Street. This airy space overlooking Herald Square and Macy's flagship store is a great place for a meal if you're catching the PATH train, a train at Penn Station, or have some shopping to do. Your day or evening will be brighter when you start with one of the Angria Spritz cocktails. The bistro fare includes a first-rate minestrone soup and a verdure salad with an enormous variety of ingredients, watercress, kale, artichokes, and golden raisins, all highlighted with a tangy red wine vinaigrette. The Caesar salad with extra chicken is less memorable, but the balsamic glazed pork ribs are perfection, making you desire a return trip. The dark chocolate mousse cake with crema gelato and the almond cake with cherry crumble and crunchy gelato earn fave raves. Chez Nous, the Marlton Hotel at 5 West 8th Street. What a transformation. This restaurant in the hotel has a totally different feel. The shutters and faux fenestration in the atrium have been replaced by a vibrant contemporary mural, and the rattan blinds covering the glass ceiling have been supplanted by soft fabric. The banquettes in the main dining room are now covered in red velvet, and the walls above them are mirrored, giving the room a very nostalgic New York touch. Cocktails feature sophisticated ice cubes and inventive concoctions. The menu is classic French bistro, with special shout-outs going to the presentation of the tuna tartare, the branzino, and the summer spaghetti. The desserts deserve high marks, with the pavlova and the profiteroles garnering a special mention. Trattoria del Arte, 907th Avenue at West 57th Street. This bustling spot, with its art-filled interior by Milton Glaser, serves up very good Tuscan-inspired Italian fare. It also features its famous antipasto bar and is a wonderfully convenient place to dine before attending a performance at Carnegie Hall. Rarely seen on menus today, it's a delight to find calf's liver delectably slivered with a rich oniony sauce over pecorino polenta. The Dover sole is classically sautéed and is worth every penny. The roasted celery root is a bit flavorless, but the vanilla meringue cake more than makes up for it. Service is friendly, and the delivery of the dessert tray is a show in itself. Corrali Estiatorio at 1662 3rd Avenue at East 93rd Street. Dining here is like taking a few hours' escape to a Greek island. Walls are whitewashed with stone arches, and the room is filled with white tables and chairs and lots of bright lighting. Go with a group for a chance to taste dozens of true Greek specialties. To begin, try a trio of dips, terra masalata, cured carp roe, tzatziki, yogurt mixed with cucumber and dill, fava santorini, yellow split pea puree, and fava santorini, yellow split pea puree. Next are the mezze, small plates to share, grilled octopus with fava, onions, and capers, and ouzo mussels cooked in a tomato broth with feta cheese, to name just a couple. From the Sea, quote-unquote, offers the freshest and juiciest grilled fish, organic salmon, branzino, dorado, swordfish, and more. The shrimp scallops kebab is served with presorizo, a rice and leek dish. From the Land, quote-unquote, offers luscious lamb or chicken souvlaki or perfectly cooked lamb chops. There's also a delicious vegetarian moussaka topped with bechamel. End the meal with the baklavas, layers of phyllo dough with mixed nuts and orange syrup. Here are some items from Barron's magazine. Apple may actually be winning the AI race. While most of big tech is sprinting to an unknown AI future, Apple is running a marathon. By Adam Levine. Apple has emerged from the AI doghouse. The stock hit a new all-time high this past week, after surging 39% since August 1st. The rally follows the botched rollout of Apple Intelligence, Apple's effort to integrate artificial intelligence into its devices. The big piece of Apple Intelligence was supposed to be a new version of Apple's digital personal assistant Siri that works like the top AI chatbots from OpenAI and Alphabet. A smarter assistant is something Apple users have craved since Siri first arrived in 2011. But the project has been indefinitely delayed. The new Siri is proving to be difficult because Apple came into the AI race by handicapping itself. It is the only big tech company that sees privacy and security as marketable features, not cost centers. Any implementation of the new Siri will need to meet Apple standards in this regard, and that is proving to be a big hurdle. Apple's strong preference for all machine learning to happen on encrypted Apple devices, leveraging special units in Apple's chips. Nothing is more private and secure. But the frontier, quote-unquote, language models that underlie ChatGPT and Gemini run in giant data centers and are far too demanding for a phone. Much smaller models that can run on a phone don't yet provide consistently good enough user experience for Apple. So we wait. Meanwhile, Wall Street seems to have moved on to a new narrative. It doesn't matter if Apple is late to AI. So far, hundreds of billions in capital expenditures are bringing big tech to the same place, AI models that struggle to stand out from each other. It turns out that having the best AI models isn't a moat, just a fleeting advantage. Many enterprise customers have said that AI language models are becoming commoditized. Most recently, Salesforce CEO Mark Benioff. Quote, we use all of the large language models, close quote, he said on the company's Wednesday third quarter earnings call. Quote, they're all very good at this point, so we can swap them in and out. The lowest cost one is the best one for us, close quote. There have been reports that Apple is in talks with Alphabet and startup Anthropic to use their AI models, fine-tuned for Apple hardware, as a stopgap until the company can create its own high-performing models. Apple is pacing itself, putting user experience and privacy above expediency. Amid everyone else's AI battle, Apple created its private cloud compute, open-source server software written in Apple's programming language, running on Apple servers that sport Apple chips. As always, the company wants to own and control the whole stack, especially when it comes to privacy and security. AI chats can include very personal information, and private cloud compute hides them from peering eyes, including Apple's. At some point, an upgraded Siri will arrive, and it will be more secure than any other chatbot. Meanwhile, Apple is keeping its powder dry, increasing capital expenditures modestly to support private cloud compute. By contrast, Meta Platforms, Oracle, Microsoft, and Google are polluting their once pristine cash flow statements and balance sheets with hundreds of billions in combined capital expenditures for AI data centers. Meta stands out, spending around $70 billion on AI data centers this year and promising more next year. It's all for its own use, not to rent out in the cloud like the others. Debt levels are rising and depreciation expenses from CapEx are beginning to mount. They will keep rising. As Alphabet's depreciation was up 41%, Microsoft's 93%, and Meta's 20%, Apple's rose just 7% in the latest quarter. If a time comes where big capital outlays make sense, Apple has plenty of room to do that. While Apple sorts out how AI fits into its software, the company's strengths remain evident. Wall Street analysts now agree that iPhone 17 will boost device sales growth to the highest level since fiscal year 2021. Services revenue continues to grow briskly, leveraging the more than 2.3 billion Apple devices being used by customers. Because it isn't raiding its cash flow statement like other big tech companies, the cash return program will continue unabated. When Apple reports its first quarter earnings, it will likely push all-time dividend payments and share buybacks past $1 trillion. Since 2012, the company has retired nearly half of its outstanding stock, raising per share metrics by 79%. And this whole discussion brings up a bigger question. How badly does Apple need AI features to sell devices? Since it became a mature category, people buy a new phone when they think they need a new phone. For better or worse, new features no longer drive smartphone sales. During the COVID-19 lockdowns of fiscal 2021, Apple iPhone sales were up 39% from the year before as customers needed new devices to work from home. iPhone 16 was heavily marketed as the Apple Intelligence phone, and sales were decent but no one's idea of a blockbuster. Now the iPhone 17 lineup is being sold in a more traditional Apple manner, with focus on hardware design and camera, and it looks to be doing much better. Those fiscal year 2021 phones are 5 years old now in fiscal 2026, and people need a new one. It's as simple as that. Apple has plenty of time. Its investors should hold on for the ride. Continuing in Barron's, Netflix wins the battle for Warner Brothers. Why the stock is dropping? Netflix has agreed to buy Warner Brothers Discovery in a deal valued at around $83 billion. Following the planned spinoff of Warner's global cable network operations. This is by Adam Clark. Netflix has agreed to buy Warner Brothers Discovery in a nearly $83 billion deal following the planned spinoff of Warner's global cable network operations. The deal values Warner Brothers Discovery at $27.75 a share, $23.25 in cash, and the remainder paid in Netflix stock. That implies a total equity value of approximately $72 billion and an enterprise value of around $82.7 billion. Netflix shares were down in early trading, battling back to flat and then dropped again. Its stock was down 0.9% at $102.31 at 11:08 a.m. Warner shares were up 3.8% to $25.47, heading for its highest close since April 2022. The deal is set to be, by far, Netflix's biggest ever acquisition and will bring it control of rights to beloved characters, including Batman and Harry Potter. However, there may be antitrust concerns amid fears that it could hand the streamer too much power over Hollywood. Quote, while we think the Department of Justice is more likely than not to challenge a Netflix deal, there are elements of a Trump transaction tax that Netflix could pay that might result in the deal being approved, close quote, wrote New Street research analyst Blair Levin in a research note before the deal was announced. Potential measures Netflix could take to soften political opposition might include a commitment to making movies and series in the U.S. President Donald Trump has repeatedly threatened to impose a 100% import tax on films produced abroad. Netflix looks to already be preparing its arguments, saying in a statement that the acquisition would allow it to significantly expand U.S. production capacity and increase investment in original content. HBO and its streaming service HBO Max will continue to operate as a standalone platform. Netflix co-CEO Ted Sarandos said on an investor call. Netflix also said it will continue to release Warner movies in theaters. Quote, with our global reach and proven business model, we can introduce a broader audience to the worlds they create, giving our members more options, attracting more fans to our best-in-class streaming service, strengthening the entire entertainment industry, and creating more value for shareholders, close quote, said Netflix co-CEO Greg Peters in a statement. The deal has angered Paramount Skydance, which has accused Warner of favoring its rival bidder. Paramount wrote in a Wednesday letter to Warner Discovery chief executive David Zaslav that the company has, quote, embarked on a myopic process with a predetermined outcome that favors a single bidder, close quote, which it believed to be Netflix, the Wall Street Journal reported. Warner, Netflix, and Paramount didn't immediately respond to requests for comments early on Friday. People familiar with the matter confirmed the letter's accuracy to Barron's. Quote, in our view, Paramount Skydance is unlikely to back off and will mount a continued challenge beyond its 5 reported prior bids, close quote, wrote benchmark research analyst Matthew Harrigan in a research note. However, Paramount could face a tough task to outbid Netflix. Harrigan said the value of the entire Warner business might now stand at more than $30 a share. Warner is currently moving ahead with plans to separate into two companies, one comprising the studio and streaming assets, and the other containing its global cable network operation. Paramount sought to buy the whole company, while Comcast and Netflix have presented offers for the streaming and studio segment, not the cable channels. Netflix's deal for Warner is expected to close after the separation of the cable division, named Discovery Global, into a new publicly traded company. That is expected to happen in the third quarter of 2026. Netflix expects the combination with Warner to result in at least $2 to $3 billion of cost savings per year by the third year of the deal's completion, and expects it to add to its earnings per share by year two. Here are some other tidbits from Barron's. PCE inflation report. Core data decelerates for the first time since April. What today's release means for the Fed's interest rates. Key takeaways. The Bureau of Economic Analysis released its Personal Consumption Expenditures Price Index data for September earlier today. Here is the report at a glance. Core YOY, 2.8% increase in line with projections, and the first time the index decelerated in months. Core MOM, 0.2% increase in line with projections. Headline YOY, 2.8% increase in line with projections. Headline MOM, 0.3% increase, slightly above the 0.2% projection. Market reaction. S&P 500 headed to a record after the PCE report and positive consumer sentiment data. Interest rates. Odds of the Fed cutting in December held steady at nearly 90%. Inflation report signals December rate cut and a cliffhanger 2026 by Nicole Goodkind. Fed officials should be able to focus on the wavering labor market and cut interest rates by another quarter percentage point at their final meeting of the year next week, thanks to relatively stable inflation data. The Fed's preferred inflation gauge slowed down on an annual basis for the first time since April. BEA data for September showed core PCE inflation, which excludes food and energy, ran at a 2.8% annual pace in September, a deceleration from August's 2.9% rate. Monthly core inflation came in at 0.2%, in line with August's numbers. While the report had markets breathing a sigh of relief, It showed that prices are still increasing well above the Fed's 2% goal, and that inflation remains stubbornly elevated. While another rate cut next week is the most likely outcome, there will likely be contentious debate and dissents from policymakers, especially considering Friday's data are 3 months old. The trajectory for interest rates in 2026 also remains cloudy. Quote, despite the likelihood of next week's rate cut, markets will be looking to see how the Fed, and especially Fed Chair Jerome Powell, describe the outlook for next year, as the future path of rate cuts is much more controversial than whether or not a single cut this month is warranted, close quote, wrote Chris Zaccarelli, Chief Investment Officer for Northlight Asset Management, in a note Friday. Economists agree. Vincent Reinhardt, Chief Economist at BNY Investments, told Barron's that we should be prepared for just one rate reduction next year because of the sticky inflationary environment. Headline inflation increased to 0.3% for the month, and the annual rate was also at 2.8%. Quote, the question will quickly shift from the December interest rate decision to the committee's 2026 projection, close quote, wrote Brett Kenwell from eToro. Quote, while inflation may not be on a runaway path higher, year-over-year PCE inched higher for the fifth straight month, while core PCE, the Fed's preferred inflation gauge, remained above 2.8% for the fifth straight reading, close quote, he noted. That backdrop raises the bar for reducing interest rates in the year ahead, particularly if the unemployment rate remains low. Quote, not only does that create a hurdle for consumers, but it could make it difficult for the Fed to follow through with aggressive rate cuts in 2026 unless the labor market is showing considerable weakness, close quote, added Kenwell. Next week also brings to the Federal Reserve's Summary of Economic Projections a forecast that will give more insight into how officials expect it to proceed with monetary policy next year and where they think rates will be at the end of 2026. For now, markets are pricing in an 87% chance of a cut in December, but only a 25% chance of another cut come January, according to the CME FedWatch tool. Americans are spending more, but not on the fun stuff, by Nicole Goodkind. U.S. consumers continue to be cautious with their wallets, spending more on basic goods and less on fun extras. Personal spending increased by 0.3% in September, according to estimates released Friday. Those gains in spending were largely concentrated on household necessities like gas and energy, housing and utilities, and healthcare. That's eased from a 0.6% increase in August. Spending on discretionary items like recreation services and goods actually decreased from the previous month by 7%, while footwear and apparel spending declined 3.8%. Inflation-adjusted spending, meanwhile, was largely flat heading into the holiday season. Quote, based on this and recent private sector data, one cannot avoid the fact that the condition of the U.S. household down market is sour at best and weak at worst, close quote, wrote RSM chief economist Joe Brusselas in a note on Friday. Quote, it is easy to get the idea that at best down market households are treading water at this time, close quote. Saving rates remained relatively steady at 4.7%. Core inflation decelerates for the first time since April, by Nicole Goodkind. Friday's inflation data could soothe some worries about price growth. In September, the Fed's preferred inflation metric slowed down on an annual basis for the first time since April, BEA data showed Friday. Core PCE inflation ran at a 2.8% annual pace in September, a deceleration from August's 2.9% rate. On a monthly basis, core PCE was steady from August to September at 0.2%. Back in April, annual core PCE slowed to a 2.5% rate from 2.6% the previous month, but continued to edge higher or remain steady in subsequent months. Disposable personal income gains eased slightly from August, by Nicole Goodkind. Personal income increased by $94.5 billion, or 0.4% at a monthly rate, in September, according to estimates released Friday by the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis. That's largely in line with August, when income also increased by 0.4%. Disposable personal income, which is personal income minus taxes without taxes, increased $75.9 billion, or 0.3%, easing from August's gains of $86.1 billion, or 0.4%. Quote, the increase in current dollar personal income in September primarily reflected increases in compensation and personal income receipts on assets, close quote, noted the BEA in the release. While these changes aren't large enough to alarm Fed officials, they do highlight concerns that the labor market and wage gains are weakening. And now, some stories from Forbes magazine. Anthropic is still hung up on AI safety. Turns out, big business loves that. Under Daniela and Dario Amodei, the wonky startup has shrugged off its doomer, quote-unquote, reputation. Now it's the go-to AI tool for thousands of companies. How long can it stay ahead of its bigger free-spending rivals? By Jeremy Kahn. Dario Amodei is, in his telling, the accidental CEO of an accidental business, one that just happens to be among the fastest growing on the planet. Quote, when we first started Anthropic, we didn't have any idea about how we would make money or when or under what conditions, close quote, he says. Anthropic is the San Francisco-based AI company that Amodei co-founded and leads. And it hasn't taken long for it to start pulling in lots of money under lots of conditions. The startup has emerged as one of the leading rivals to OpenAI and Google in the race to build ever more capable artificial intelligence. And while Anthropic and its Claude family of AI models don't have quite the same brand recognition as crosstown rival OpenAI and its ChatGPT products, over the past year, Claude has quietly emerged as the model that businesses seem to like best. Anthropic, currently valued at $183 billion, has by some metrics pulled ahead of its larger rivals, OpenAI and Google, in enterprise usage. The company is on track to hit an annualized run rate of close to $10 billion by year-end, more than 10 times what it generated in 2024. It also told investors in August that it could bring in as much as $26 billion in 2026 and a staggering $70 billion in 2028. Even more remarkably, Anthropic is generating such growth without spending nearly as much as some rivals, at a time when massive capital expenditures across the industry are stoking anxiety about an AI bubble. OpenAI alone has signed AI infrastructure deals worth more than $1 trillion. That's in part because Anthropic says it has found ways to train and run its AI models more efficiently. To be sure, Anthropic is nowhere near profitable today. It was pacing to end 2025 having consumed $2.8 billion more cash than it took in, according to recent news accounts citing forecasts provided to investors. But the company is also on track to break even in 2028, according to those projections, 2 years ahead of OpenAI. On the AI infrastructure spending race, Amodei can be sardonic. Quote, these announcements are kind of frothy, close quote, he says. Quote, business should care about bringing in cash, not setting cash on fire, right? Close quote. Of his rivals, he quips, quote, can you buy so many data centers that you overleverage yourself? All I'll say is some people are trying, close quote. Anthropic's commercial traction is in some ways profoundly ironic. The company was founded in 2020 by Amodei, his sister Daniela, and five other former OpenAI employees who broke away from that company in part because they were concerned it was putting too much emphasis on commercial products over quote-unquote AI safety, the effort to ensure AI doesn't pose significant risks to humanity. At Anthropic, safety was going to be the sine qua non. Quote, AI safety continues to be the highest level focus, close quote, Amodei says of Anthropic as we sit in his office in a building adjacent to Salesforce Tower that once housed the offices of Slack and whose 10 stories are now completely occupied by Anthropic. But the company soon found that Amodei calls quote-unquote synergies between its work on safety and building models that would appeal to enterprises. Quote, businesses value trust and reliability, close quote, he says. In another twist, the emphasis on trust and caution that has helped Anthropic gain traction with big business has entangled the company in conflicts with influential figures in politics and business. Key Trump administration officials range from skeptical to downright hostile to Anthropic's positions on AI safety and its advocacy for regulation. The company has clashed with NVIDIA CEO Jensen Huang over Anthropic's support for limiting exports of AI chips to China, and with Salesforce CEO Mark Benioff over Amodei's warnings about AI-induced job losses. The opprobrium of these influential figures is just one obstacle Anthropic is navigating. It has also faced lawsuits over its use of copyrighted books and music to train Claude. It agreed to settle one class-action lawsuit with authors over its use of pirated libraries of books for $1.5 billion in September. That's cash the company would rather spend on growth, but had it lost in court, Anthropic might have been bankrupted. It's a lot for a young company to manage, especially one undergoing hypergrowth. Anthropic had fewer than 200 employees in late 2023. Today it has approximately 2,300. It's hiring an army of salespeople, customer support engineers, and marketing professionals, even as it staffs up on researchers to push the frontier of AI development. It's also expanding internationally at a rapid clip. Just since September, it has opened Paris and Tokyo offices and announced ones in Munich, Seoul, and Bengaluru, adding to its existing global footprint of Dublin, Zurich, and London. Having established itself as the, quote, AI company for business, close quote, Anthropic's challenge is to keep that title in an industry where performance leaderboards can shift overnight and market gains can quickly disappear. As its rocket ship burns through the stratosphere, the question is, can Anthropic achieve escape velocity? Or will powerful forces, the gravitational pull of the immense costs associated with cutting-edge AI models, the buffeting winds from political turbulence and intense competition, and the internal pressures inherent in managing an organization growing at supersonic rates, send it spinning back down to Earth? Dario Amodei has a head of curly brown hair, and as he speaks, he absentmindedly twirls a lock of it around his finger, as if reeling back in the thoughts unspooling from his lips as he muses about AI security and trust issues like quote-unquote prompt injection and hallucinations. Many of the mysteries Anthropic is most interested in unlocking through its research, how to make sure models adhere to human intentions and instructions, what's known in the AI field as quote-unquote alignment, and how to peer inside the brains of large language models to figure out why they generate certain outputs or quote-unquote interpretability, are things businesses care about too. The 42-year-old Amodei has a penchant for dressing in what might best be described as academic chic. The day we meet, he's wearing a shawl-necked navy sweater over a white t-shirt with blue trousers and dark Brooks running shoes, rounding off the look. It's perhaps a sartorial vestige of his former life, prior to his current role. He had always been a scientist, first in physics, then computational neuroscience, and finally AI research. Quote, when I started this company, I'd never run a company before, and I certainly didn't know anything about business, close quote, Amodei says. Quote, but the best way to learn, especially something practical like that, is just doing it and iterating fast, close quote. While Dario focuses on vision, strategy, research, and policy, sister Daniela, who is nearly 4 years younger, serves as Anthropic's president, handles day-to-day operations, and oversees the commercial side of the business. Quote, we're like yin and yang, close quote, in roles and responsibilities, Daniela says of herself and Dario, but quote-unquote extremely aligned on values and direction. She allows that one of the benefits of working with your sibling is that there's always someone around who can call you on your bullshit. Quote, you have sibling privileges, close quote, she says. Quote, sometimes I'm like, hey, I know this is what you meant, but people didn't hear it that way. Or he'll just be like, you're coming across, you're cranky, close quote. Under the Amodei's, Anthropic's emphasis on business has helped it to differentiate itself from OpenAI, which has 800 million weekly users and has increasingly catered to them by rolling out consumer products, from viral video creation tool Sora to an instant checkout feature for e-commerce. Claude has tens of millions of individual users, according to news accounts. Anthropic hasn't disclosed those numbers, but Anthropic says most of these people are using Claude for work and productivity, not for entertainment or companionship. Amodei says focusing on enterprises better aligns Anthropic's incentives around safety with those of its customers. Consumer-focused businesses, he says, tend to wind up trying to monetize users' attention through advertising, which gives them an incentive to make products addictive. That, he says, leads to apps that serve up quote-unquote AI slop or chatbots designed to serve as quote-unquote AI girlfriends. Amodei doesn't mention OpenAI by name, but that company has made controversial moves toward doing both those things. Quote, for each of these things, it's not that I object in principle, close quote, he says. Quote, there could be good ways to do them, but I'm not sure the incentives point toward the good way, close quote. More important for enterprise customers, safety is a persuasive selling point. Many feel that as a result of Anthropic's innovations, it is harder for users to push Claude to jump its guardrails and produce problematic outputs, whether that's giving someone instructions for making a bioweapon, revealing company secrets, or spewing hate speech. Whatever their motives, business customers are eagerly signing up. The company says it has more than 300,000 enterprise customers and that the number of those on pace to spend more than $100,000 annually with the company has risen sevenfold in the past year. Menlo Ventures, an Anthropic investor, has released survey data showing it with about a third of the enterprise market, compared with 25% for OpenAI and about 20% for Google Gemini. OpenAI disputes the reliability of these numbers, noting that it has more than 1 million business customers. But data that the company shared with investors this summer showed that Anthropic had pulled ahead of its much larger rival in revenue derived from their respective APIs, the interfaces through which enterprises access their models when building AI-enabled products and services. Anthropic reported $3.1 billion from its API, compared with $2.9 billion for OpenAI. Nick Johnston, who leads the Strategic Technology Partnerships team at Salesforce, says Salesforce's own customers, especially in finance and healthcare, pushed his company to forge a closer relationship with Anthropic because they felt the model was more secure than competitors. Public safety benchmarks run by independent organizations bear this out. Some of Claude's better performance is down to a technique Anthropic pioneered called quote-unquote constitutional AI. This involves giving Claude a written constitution, a set of principles, that is used to train the model. Anthropic drew the principles for Claude's current constitution from sources as varied as the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Apple's Terms of Service, and rules that Anthropic competitor Google DeepMind developed and published for Swallow, a chat box it created in 2022. Dave Orr, Anthropic's head of safeguards, says there's much more that goes into making Claude secure. The company screens out certain information, such as scientific papers on potentially dangerous viruses, from Claude's initial training data. It also applies what it calls quote-unquote constitutional classifiers, other AI models that screen users' prompts for jailbreaking attempts, and monitor Claude's outputs to ensure they comply with the Constitution. Anthropic employs quote-unquote red teamers to probe for vulnerabilities that Orr's team then try to fix. It also has a quote-unquote threat intelligence group that investigates users whose prompts raise red flags. That team has uncovered Chinese hackers using Claude to penetrate critical infrastructure networks in Vietnam and North Korean fraudsters using Claude to land IT jobs at U.S. companies. Anthropic executives stress that Claude's reliability as a business tool is essentially inextricable from its emphasis on safety. Kate Jensen, who leads Anthropic's American operation and was until recently head of sales and partnerships, says that a lot of customers prefer Claude because they trust it to just work. Does the model rarely hallucinate? Can it follow instructions reliably? Quote, does the model do what you ask it to do? Yes or no? Close quote, she asks rhetorically. Quote, that shouldn't really be a massive enterprise differentiator, but right now in AI, it is. And for us, it's always been table stakes. Close quote. Indeed, Claude has been winning enterprise customers largely because it performs better than rivals at tasks businesses care about. This has been particularly true for coding, where Claude has, until recently, dominated almost all the public performance benchmarks. Claude drafts about 90% of Anthropic's own code, although human software developers check it and edit it. Quote-unquote Claude Code, a tool specifically for software developers that debuted in February, supercharged Claude's adoption. David Kosnick, head of AI products at design software company Figma, says his company built many of its early generative AI features using OpenAI's models. But when Figma decided to create Figma Make, a product that lets users design and build functional prototypes and working apps from typed instructions, it chose Claude to power it. Quote, Anthropic's code generation was consistently impressive, close quote, he says. Figma still uses OpenAI and Google models for other features. Figma is one of many companies whose relationship with Claude was boosted by Anthropic's close partnership with Amazon and its cloud computing arm AWS. Amazon has committed to invest $8 billion in Anthropic, and it has integrated Anthropic's models deeply into AWS, making it easy for customers to use Claude with their data. Given that AWS is the world's largest cloud provider, that has helped drive business to Anthropic. Anthropic has relationships with Google Cloud and Microsoft Azure, too. And recently, IBM, whose AI strategy had been built around open source models, made an exception and struck a strategic partnership with Anthropic to integrate Claude into select products, even though Claude is an open source. Rob Thomas, IBM's chief commercial officer, says IBM was excited about Claude's ability to work with its proprietary libraries of coding data, particularly in older languages such as Java and COBOL. The Latin of programming languages, COBOL, powers Big Blue's mainframes, which are still used in banking, insurance, healthcare, and the U.S. government. But skilled COBOL coders have largely retired. IBM has used Claude in conjunction with other AI models to create Project Bob, an agentic tool it plans to release in 2026 that can carry out various software tasks, including modernizing COBOL-written programs. If coding is the gateway drug for many Anthropic customers, a growing number are discovering Claude's uncanny abilities at other tasks. Novo Nordisk, the pharmaceutical giant best known these days for its blockbuster diabetes and weight loss drug Ozempic, evaluated a host of AI models in an effort to reduce the time it takes to prepare the reams of paperwork involved in clinical trials. Waheed Jawiya, the company's digitalization strategy director, says Novo Nordisk built a system around Claude that has taken the time required to compile clinical trial reports down from 12 to 15 weeks to just 10 to 15 minutes. Microsoft, a major investor in OpenAI, had been using OpenAI's models exclusively to power its Copilot in-office productivity software, but it found Claude was better at handling Excel spreadsheets and PowerPoint presentations and switched accordingly. Both Deloitte and Cognizant have adopted Claude company-wide and are helping Anthropic co-sell Claude to their own clients. Another revenue scaling opportunity, since big companies rely on such firms' consulting work to get value from generative AI. Anthropic has begun rolling out tailored versions of Claude for specific confessions, but it's cautious about launching too many quote-unquote verticals. Mike Krieger, the Instagram co-founder, who is now Anthropic's chief product officer, says it will create tailored products only if they will help either solve some confounding aspect of general-purpose intelligence or create what he calls a quote-unquote flywheel effect that accelerates progress towards superhuman AI. Krieger says Claude Code checked the second box, offering the prospect of AI models writing code for future models. Claude for Financial Services, which launched in July, checked the first one, since building accurate financial models requires lots of reasoning steps. The company has a quote-unquote frontier prototyping team that builds internal products designed to push the envelope of what Claude can do, with an eye toward commercializing them if they succeed. For all its abilities, plenty remains beyond Claude's grasp. When Anthropic teamed up with Andon Labs, an AI safety testing outfit, to see if Claude Sonnet 3.7 could run the vending machines in Anthropic's San Francisco headquarters, it fared disastrously. The model failed to raise prices on in-demand items, told employees to remit payments through an account that didn't exist, offered all Anthropic staff a 25% discount, not realizing the impact that would have on profits in an office in which pretty much everyone worked for Anthropic, and decided to stock tungsten cubes, an expensive but useless novelty item. Tungsten cubes briefly became an Anthropic office meme. While Anthropic works to up Claude's vending machine game, its rivals aren't standing still. OpenAI is reportedly working on a product to directly challenge Claude for Financial Services. Its newest coding product, GPT-5 Codex, has narrowly bested Anthropic on some software development benchmarks. Google's new Gemini 2.5 Pro model also has decent coding skills and performs competitively with Claude on many reasoning tasks. Each of those models is considerably cheaper than Claude, and a number of Chinese AI companies have produced powerful coding models that they've released for free. Right now, most enterprises are willing to pay more for AI models to gain even a slight advantage in accuracy on essential tasks. But that could change as the gap between the performance of different AI models narrows. That means price could become Anthropic's Achilles heel. IBM's Thomas says, quote, "I don't think Bob would hit the mark for users if Anthropic wasn't there. But if we'd only built on Claude, we'd probably miss the mark on price," close quote. In June, Anysphere, the startup behind the AI-powered software development platform Cursor, angered many users when it jacked up prices. AnySphere blamed the increase partly on Anthropic because Cursor relies heavily on Claude under the hood. Around the same time, Anthropic reduced the number of requests its own paid subscribers could make for a given subscription tier, in essence, a stealth price hike. Daniela Amadai acknowledges that Anthropic's price changes were not communicated well, but she adds that, quote, pricing in the AI industry is like an acid trip, close quote, and that, quote, everyone in the industry, including us, is still doing some form of price discovery because it's just evolving so quickly, close quote. She also says that Anthropic has created smaller, less expensive models, such as its Claude Haiku series, which perform certain tasks just as well as its massive Claude 4.1 Opus at a fraction of the price. Quote, depending on the use case, you might not need the Ferrari, close quote, she says. Left unsaid, if you do need the Ferrari, don't expect Chevy prices. The two siblings have also had to be intentional about separating work from family life. Daniela says Dario comes to her house most Sundays to hang out with her family. They'll play video games and play with her kids, but work talk is verboten. Quote, this is a separate time that's just for us, because we were siblings before we were co-founders, close quote, she says. Amadai tells me he remains convinced that AGI, human-like artificial general intelligence, and then AI superintelligence loom on the horizon, and he denies being a doomer, quote-unquote. Yes, he's worried about potential dangers from models that will make it easier for someone to engineer a bioweapon to large-scale job displacement, but he thinks AGI will help cure many diseases, and wants those cures to arrive as soon as possible. And he firmly believes AI could supercharge the economy. Quote, the GDP growth is going to inflect upwards quite a lot if we get this right, close quote, he says. Another thing he's optimistic about, Anthropic's continued revenue acceleration. He's a scientist. He gets the law of big numbers. Companies don't keep growing at 10x for long. Quote, I'm an AI optimist, but I'm not that crazy, close quote, he says. Still, he thinks Anthropic could surpass OpenAI as the world's largest AI company by revenue. Quote, I would argue it's maybe even the most likely world in which our revenue passes theirs a year from now, close quote, he says. Then he pauses before adding, quote, I think I'd rather have the largest revenue than the largest data center, because one is black on an income statement and the other is red. Again, things I've had to learn about business, it's better to make money than just to lose money. You've been listening to Down to Business. My name's Greg Conroy. This is brought to you by the good folks at Mind's Eye Organization, helping the low vision and blind communities in the St. Louis region since 1973. Have a great week. Take care.